This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Louis Malmadrona has practiced emergency medicine in hospitals from California to New York for over two decades. He's also assisted with and led Native American healing ceremonies. He says he respects modern medicine, but also realizes its limitations. During his education at Stanford University School of Medicine, he realized that his Native American heritage was worthy of study and attention. Eventually, he found ways of combining modern medicine and Native healing traditions. He says that integrating the two approaches makes perfect sense for him, since he is part white and part Native. He's written a new book called Coyote Medicine. He told me that his great-grandmother was considered a healer.
She was Cherokee, and she died when I was five. And so I don't have much theoretical knowledge of what she did. I just remember people coming and going and sounds and smells coming out of her room. And I remember growing up in an environment where people believed that going to people like her would help you to get well.
You write about how some of your relatives combined Native tradition with a belief in Jesus, and that they had a very Native American approach to Christianity. Maybe you could describe a little bit about what that combination was like.
Sure. My grandmother was probably the best example. My grandmother was a simple person. She finished the third grade, and she worked in the Greyhound bus station selling tickets. And she liked to go to all kinds of religious ceremonies. She went to the Cherokee, she went to the faith handlers, she went to the Pentecostal, to the Baptist church. And she would just put together her own blend of everything that she encountered. She had an idea that Jesus was the chief of all human spirits. And then she developed an idea that Mary was the chief of all women human spirits, and so that Mary was in charge of birthing and reproductive kinds of things. And so she had kind of worked out a Christian-like cosmology in her mind. And I remember when we went to the Baptist church and they talked about hell, she would put her hands over my ears and she would say, "Now don't listen to that, because the Creator wouldn't do something like that. The Creator is too loving and too kind," she said. If there's a hell, she said, "it's here on earth. It's nothing after you die." And so she wouldn't let me listen to that kind of thing. And it wasn't until much later in life that I realized that Christianity was different from her conception of it.
When you were a child, you wanted to be a scientist, and when you started thinking about med school, you wanted to be a researcher. You weren't thinking about actually working with people who were sick. And then it was only after you got deeper into medicine that you started to think about combining Native American approaches to healing with Western medicine.
Yes. When I started medical school, I had already done most of the basic courses as an undergraduate, so I started in the clinical rotations almost immediately. And to my surprise, I discovered that I really liked taking care of patients. And I was working on the urology service, and I kept, in the back of my mind, I kept thinking that there would be a course on healing, and that there would be someone to teach me who had already done this integration. And I began to discover that my professors really weren't interested in these deeper questions of what about healing, and what about the price these people are paying for our high-tech medicine. And about that time, one of my friends, who was a Native American from Wyoming, invited me to go home with him to his reservation for a ceremony. And I had been starting to think that this was a good thing. And so I went with him, and I went into a ceremony on his reservation. And that began to open me up, and I began to want to recover that wisdom of my childhood.
What was the ceremony like?
Well, the first part of the ceremony was a sweat lodge. And sweat lodges are common here in Colorado, but maybe not as common on the East Coast. And they're small, sort of dome-like structures that nowadays are covered with sheets and blankets and tarps and sometimes plastic. And you heat the stones outside of the lodge, and they're carried in with a pitchfork and put in the center in a pit, and water is poured on them, and the blanket is closed over the door, and it's It's absolutely dark and very hot, and everyone sits around the pit, and the leader sings, and everyone sings with him, and there's prayers, and it's a time of purification. And this was my first sweat lodge, and when I went in, I saw these very old men, some of them in their 90s. I thought, piece of cake, not a problem. But once we were inside, I couldn't believe how hot it was. And I couldn't believe the stamina of these old men. And my friend and I thought I was going to die, actually. It was so hot. But we persevered. You know, we hung in there because we didn't want to lose face to these old men. Everyone had come there to support a man that had angina. And he was too sick to come in the sweat lodge, so we had gone in for him. And then that night, we had a ceremony in a teepee. And it was off a dirt road and hard to get to, and when we got there it was dark, and you could see the shadows of the people inside the teepee because there was a bright fire going inside the teepee, and everyone was sitting around the circle, and the medicine man would stand up, and there would be songs, and tobacco rolled in a corn husk would be passed around to smoke for the prayers to go to the Creator, and the fire in the middle eventually, as the night progressed, took the shape of a thunderbird. And it was incredibly beautiful and incredibly moving to be a part of the singing and the drumming and the praying and the supporting this man that had angina.
So what was his outcome?
He stopped having chest pain. And he went back to work. And I kept track of him through my friend for 3-4 years, and he was doing great. I should add that the medicine man did a lot of counseling with him and gave him herbs to drink and worked with his family and did more than just the ceremony and continued to work with him after the ceremony. So it wasn't just a one-time event. But until I lost track of my friend, I kept hearing good reports about this man.
Tell me about another traditional healer who had a great influence on how you practice now.
Well, one of the women that I learned the most from is right here in Colorado, and her name is Marilyn Youngbird. And Marilyn taught me a lot about traditional counseling, and she taught me a lot about the sweat lodge and how to take care of people in the sweat lodge, how to lead the sweat lodge.
Tell me a little bit about how her approach to healing and what you've taken from her style.
Well, one of the things that I would do is bring patients to Marilyn from my practice, and I would watch how she would work with them. And she was a combination of stern and compassionate, that she demanded things from people. She demanded that they meet her with their intention to be well, and that they took responsibility for what they could do to help themselves. And at the same time, she was very forgiving and compassionate. And she would understand that they were doing the best they could do with what they had. And that her job was to show them how to feel more supported and to feel more loved and to feel more forgiven. And to connect them with the Creator and with the spirits who could make them feel better about themselves. And so what I learned from Marilyn was to be both demanding from people, but also to be loving and compassionate with people, which I thought was her forte.
Can you give us an example of how she worked with somebody who was sick, who she saw?
I remember I took her a man who had prostate cancer that had spread to a couple bones. And he was a man that he knew, for instance, that he should stop smoking, and he was a man that had a lot of relationships and would go from person to person and had a lot of trouble with commitment. And Marilyn looked him in the eye and said, "You're going to stop doing both of these things right now." And she said, "And what's more, I'm going to help you. Anytime you feel like lighting a cigarette, you call me instead. Anytime you feel like running around with someone that isn't good for your soul, then you call me on the phone and I will talk to you and we'll work it through. But you are going to stop doing these things right now because you know it's bad for you. You know you have to do everything you can do to help yourself. And we're going to change your whole daily routine. We're going to create time for you to take care of yourself, to I'm gonna give you some herbs to drink, and you're gonna drink all this fresh water, and you're gonna eat the right food, and you're gonna have time for prayer, and you're gonna stop making up excuses," she said. "And anytime you make an excuse, you're gonna call me, and I'm gonna talk you through it." So she was firm and demanding on the one hand, but incredibly compassionate to him on the other hand. And she would say, "I know you were doing the best you could do, but now I'm on your side. I'm helping you. And you've got this doctor over here who really cares about you." And she would be referring to me, "and he's going to help you. And together we're going to bring more resources to bear on this problem. We're going to call in spirits that can help you."
You know what I like about that? Sometimes when you want to change, you feel like, oh, I failed before and I'm going to fail again. I can't do it. But when she says, but, you know, we're part of a team now and I'm bringing everything I have to bear on this, then there's a reason to feel, well, maybe I can really undergo this transformation because I've got extra help.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I learned from working with medicine people, is this idea that, you know, when people come to you, they're already doing the best they can do. And so, you know, in conventional medicine, we just lecture people. You know, we tell them, oh, you got to stop smoking. You got to start exercising. You got to lose weight. But we don't take into account that they're already struggling. They're already suffering. They're already doing the best they can do. And what they need from us is that support that I saw the traditional medicine people giving their patients, giving their clients, that I saw Marilyn giving this man.
So did this help him change his behavior?
And it did.
What was his medical outcome?
Well, he eventually died, but he lived a lot longer than anybody thought that he would. And I think probably the most important thing was that he made peace with people from his past. He made peace with his daughters, who he had been estranged from when he first came to see Marilyn. And he made peace with his ex-wives. And in a sense, he made peace with himself. And I think that's something important to remember, that sometimes healing takes many forms. You know, we can't always create a dramatic miracle like somebody getting over metastatic cancer. But we do everything we can to restore whatever balance and harmony we can in their life. And sometimes that manifests in the family or with relationships or with a better dying process than they would have otherwise had.
My guest is Dr. Luis Mal Madrona, author of the new book Coyote Medicine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Luis Mal Madrona, is the author of Coyote Medicine, a book about how he integrates modern medicine and Native American healing traditions. Tell me how you use some of your conventional specialties. How often do you use antibiotics or antipsychotics? And the whole other, medicine chest of pharmaceuticals out there.
Well, my belief is that what conventional medicine is really good at are quick fixes. And so if somebody is really in trouble, we can do a lot of good for them. And if somebody comes in and they have an infection that's severe, it's spreading all over their leg, let's say, I'd be happy to put in an IV and give them IV antibiotics. And I'm really proud that I know how to do those things and glad of it. But at the same time, I realized that the healing process, let's say if somebody got banged up really bad in a car accident, that they're going to need a lot more than just these procedures that I know how to do. They're going to need maybe prayer, or they're going to need imagery, or they're going to need someone touching them. So when something quick is needed, I have no hesitation to use medication. Or if somebody, you know, if the alternative is for somebody to get locked up in a psychiatry unit that they feel is really going to be damaging to them, I'd be happy to give them an antipsychotic medication. But I think when you give someone a medication, then it's time to work with them to help them to get well so that maybe someday in the future they don't have to take it, or they don't have to take as much of it, and that's what I try to do.
What do you consider to be the equivalent of your medicine bag?
Well, I have a medicine bag, actually. I mean, I have...
What's in it?
I have my sacred pipe, which is something that is a way of communing with God, with the Creator, that's used in the Lakota way of being. I have crystals, I have plants, I have herbs that I use and burn. I have feathers that I use to fan people. These are things that I work with, and so I pray over them and sit with them and spend time with them. So they, I believe and I feel that they take on some good energy, that they become sacred objects in that respect.
It must be almost funny to have a sacred pipe in this era where just smoking is so universally condemned, except by the people who still smoke. You know, and smoking is this like universal symbol of self-destruction.
Well, you know, among the Cherokee and among Native peoples, there have always been substances that are sacred, that are used in a sacred manner, that Anglo-Europeans then pick up and abuse. A good example of that comes from the Andes, where the cocoa leaf is chewed in sacred ceremonies. Now, they don't abuse it at the Andes. They only use it for sacred purposes, but the sort of modern, quick, addictive Anglo-European culture turns it into cocaine and abuses it. Or if you look at the people of the Native American church that use peyote, they only use it in ceremony, and they only use it in a manner that helps them to get strong and to heal. They're not like the so-called hippies who use it to get high or to hallucinate.
What about tobacco? How do you use tobacco?
Well, tobacco is considered a sacred plant, and it's only used in ceremony. And the belief is that when you smoke the tobacco, whatever is in your mind goes across the Milky Road to the lodge of the Creator, to where the Creator lives. And in general, most people that I know don't inhale the tobacco. We don't breathe it into our lungs. We transform it through the pipe. We transform the plant, the tobacco plant, into smoke, which can carry the prayers of the people at the ceremony.
You mentioned you keep feathers in your medicine bag. What are the feathers for?
They're eagle feathers, and I use them in ceremonies to bless people with, to fan them, you know, to fan smoke over them and things like that. And I also have some other feathers from owls and turkeys that I use sometimes when there's a need for that kind of energy, for that kind of influence.
What kind of influence might owl or turkey feathers have?
Well, they say that the owl is a bird that can go back and forth to the spirit world and bring back messages from the spirit world or from dead relations. And so if that's needed, I might use an owl feather. And I'll give you another example, a buzzard. Buzzards are supposed to be, in this tradition, a buzzard is supposed to be fully honest. A buzzard can't lie. And so if we're really searching for the truth, we might use a buzzard feather. And, you know, turkeys are an original inhabitant of North America, and they have their own kind of wisdom that has to do with providing for the people, you know, with sustenance and nurturing. And so if I needed that, I might use a turkey feather.
You've said that in Native American medicine, diseases have a certain spirit, and it's part of your job to understand what that spirit is. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. One of the ways of working with an illness is to externalize it so the person can struggle with it. And so often in imagery work that I do with someone, I will help them to form a really clear mental picture of the illness as an actual entity, as a being, as something that they could reach out and touch in their mind's hand, something they could see in their mind's eye. And as you work with an illness, you begin to feel, as you work with enough people that have an illness, sometimes you feel a kind of similarity between the pictures that people create. And this is what I mean by a spirit of an illness. I've done a lot of work with AIDS patients, and many of them are incredibly noble, but there's something about the spirit of AIDS that's to me is kind of dark, and it's despairing, and it's a little bit malevolent, like these viruses trying to eat away a person's defenses. So So the concept has to, it's helpful in working with someone because they can see the illnesses outside themselves. And the minute you can put it outside of someone, then it becomes other. And it's a lot easier to rid yourself of an other than it is to rid yourself of a part of yourself.
What do you do when you get sick?
Well, I go to medicine people. I go to an acupuncturist that I trust. I pray. I sit down and do a ceremony, smoke the pipe, ask God to help me, ask the Creator to help me out. Sometimes I just lie in the bed. You know, if I know it's a short-term illness, sometimes I figure it's my right to just lie there and not do anything, and then I don't try and get better real fast.
Dr. Louis Malmadrona is the author of Coyote Medicine. He teaches at the Native American Research and Training Center at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson.